Buglers, we are live from Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of September with Chris Addison and Alice Fraser. It might be our only London date of the year, so get your tickets now. Oh, get them at thebuglepodcast.com. That bit's important.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is a podcast from The Bugle.
Welcome to Tiny Revolutions. I'm your host, Tiff Stevenson, and today I have with me, how can I describe her? Actress, director, filmmaker, writer, activist, the fantastic Maisie Richardson-Sellers. I'm going to applaud you on.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
I'm very, very excited to have you on because everyone that I've invited onto the podcast has been a tiny revolution to me in some way. So I've known you a couple of years. And we're going to talk about your work and tell people about you in a bigger, broader sense. First of all, I want to kind of say, like, how old are you? Do you mind me asking?
Yeah, no, I'm just turned 29. I'm still adjusting.
So this is one of the things that struck me about Maisie when I first met her. Just how much she's achieved before 30. It's kind of, it's a bit frightening. It's frightening. It's mind blowing. You've directed your first short film and you're doing all this fantastic work. And I was blown away by the fact that you had so much to say, so much verve, and a really amazing way of saying it.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about that in detail, but this Tiny Revolutions, originally as a podcast, was sort of born out of the George Orwell quote that each joke is a tiny revolution. Now, in this new series, we're expanding that brief to talk about art as tiny revolutions and the art that has moved you and the moments and the social moments and movements you've been involved with. So, first question really is, how did you become this, right? How did you become Maisie Richardson-Sellers?
That's a fantastic question.
How did you become this, like, design or happy accident? Was it always your plan to act? Was it always your plan to then write and direct and do this other stuff? Tell me about it.
Yeah, so both my parents are actors, predominantly in theatre. So I very much grew up in that theatre space, you know, backstage, on tour. And I think I fell in love with it. My mom did a play, I think it was The Winter's Tale, and I was three. And my dad took me to see the curtain call, just the ending, because he was like, the rest might be a bit much. And I watched the curtain call and he says, I just pointed and I was like, I want to do that. And it was kind of from then I was just hooked. But I also loved academics and writing and history and English. So that's why I went to Oxford and did anthropology and archaeology. And for a while I thought, maybe I'm going to become an anthropologist, make documentaries for the UN and like kind of go down that route. And then my agent happened to see me in a play that I did at Oxford and I got a call. And they're like, have you ever been interested in acting? And I was like, funny you should say that. And that's kind of how it all happened. So it was a bit of a part destiny, part skip, tumble, trip, I don't know, but here I am, exploring them all.
I love that you're like 3 years old and you're like, yes, I want to do that. What do you think it is at such a young age? Do you think it's lights, attention? Is it everyone's eyes in the room, or is it the excitement of this gathering, of this moment?
I think what's especially always drawn to me with theatre and why I always thought I would predominantly be doing theatre, ironically, but it's the energy with the audience. It's that relationship you build. It's the fact, it's the captivation. I think at that age probably was also the, you know, the attention, but there's something which is so electric about being in that space and feeling the audience change and go on a journey with you. And, you know, I mean, you know what it's like. You can feel when you've got them in the palm of your hand or when they're distracted and having to work them back in. And it's such an amazing dynamic. And I think that is addictive for me.
But I do think rooms hold energy. They say it about comedy clubs, the laughter's held in the walls. So like this passion and energy. And I think as kids, we're much more sensitive to that kind of thing. I think we cut ourselves off a bit as adults and we doubt our intuition and our gut instinct and stuff like that. I'm hazarding a guess here, but there was something in Tiny You that went, there's power and, yeah, and drama and excitement and passion in this kind of...
Definitely. You can smell it. You can taste it.
And then you went, I'm going to go and study archaeology or anthropology.
Yeah, and both of them.
Right. Wow. Oh my God.
Yeah. So that was a journey. Off on digs. I did a dig in Albania, which was really cool. Excavated a Greco-Roman child's grave, which was... Yeah, I mean, you literally have this child, you know, the teeth and everything are still there and you're just brushing it and it feels a little wrong, actually.
Right.
Because, you know, this child has been put here by its parents, probably. And who are we to come along and to take it up and put it in plastic bags and send it to a lab? But it was an amazing experience. I did love it.
Do you think anything in that informed in that kind of... digging, archaeology, anthropology, that study of people and history, is there stuff in there that's informed what you're doing now?
Definitely. I think mostly from the social anthropology side of things, because at the end of the day, it's a study of people, it's a study of culture, it's a study of what makes us different. And that is kind of what acting is all about. You're embodying someone else, their culture, their lives, their experiences. And I think because I know so much about the vastness of possibilities within the human experiences, it actually works within my acting as well. And whenever I create a character, I go deep into their sort of cultural background, their religious background, their spiritual background, who their family are. Like, I map out their whole world. And I think that has come from the sort of anthropologist in me, who's very much the observer and loves to piece together different cultures and societies.
What were your first sort of memories of, or your earliest memories of, like, politics? And the idea of, like, political, like, memories, whether it was seeing a politician on TV or whether it was a movement, some kind of march or activism. And I don't know how much your mum and dad are involved in that kind of thing.
Very much so, especially my dad. I mean, he's been marching since long before I existed. He was very involved in, like, the anti-apartheid marches. He's definitely got an anarchist side to him, which got passed down to me. And very much about using your body and your voice in order to help be a part and push movements along. I remember the first march I went on consciously was the anti-Iraq march.
Me too.
In London. Yeah, and that was the first one that I remember clocking it and being like, wow, power of the people. And seeing all those people and seeing how peaceful it was, but also feeling a part of something so powerful and large and bigger than me, really, really stuck with me. And, you know, for me, so much about movements and activism is about empowering the group and uplifting as a group and remembering our individual roles and power within the larger system. And how we can influence and how important it is to use our voices and how I think we have a responsibility to use our voices, especially when you are in the public eye. I don't think passivity is an option if you have influence.
And it is empowering to feel part of a movement and like you're not just one voice.
Definitely. And exactly. And it builds community as well. And it's so nice to have people. I get so fed up with conversations when I go and see... meet new people, and it's just all about surface things. And, you know, for me, I have to go that step deeper. Like, I just don't have interest in small talk. So I surround myself with people, as you probably know, who are very sort of politically minded and outspoken. So to be able to be in those spaces where that is also the energy as well is really, it feeds me.
Yes. Yeah, I totally agree with that. And small talk, I think I saw someone tweet this recently, can be really quite tiring.
Yeah, it is. It takes so much energy.
If there's not a realness to it, an out of politeness kind of like, oh, and how are you? Like, how are you? But I'm asking, but I don't really care what the answer is.
Yeah, exactly. And one thing, because I filmed in South Africa for a year in total in two separate occasions. And, you know, apartheid ended in 1994, which is so recent. So when you go there, conversation, you know, you meet someone in a bar outside, had a few drinks, and instantly you'll be talking about politics and about race and about life. And it's just so, it's like, this is how it should be to me.
Right.
Whereas I think we kind of got comfortable as a generation. You know, we had it kind of easy compared to our parents in terms of, this is the first time there's been a big sort of political, social uproar in my lifetime. So I think, therefore, people don't really realize the importance of these conversations because they haven't had to. It has, you know, their lives haven't depended on it before.
And I think families who talk about it or chew it out, because there are families who will say it's kind of not polite to talk about it, or it's not polite to talk about money or politics, or let's not, because everyone just, let's have a nice time, you know.
Like, yeah, definitely.
You know, in my family, we thrash it out as well, you know, and we can have different points of view. But I think that's vital as well. It's vital to be able to, like, kind of talk about what's going on in the world and try and, you know, I've got a stepson, I'm trying to get him to understand politics and movements and equality and feminism, and you know, like he's at that age, you know.
Definitely. And you have to do it from kid. Like, I remember, you know, going back to my parents, I would be at the dinner table with them, all their friends, every, you know, I'm an only child, but I would always be at the table. I would never be sent to bed, never eat my dinner separately. So I would be involved in all these conversations, and they would always be like, what do you think, Maisie? They would always challenge me and question me. And so I think that was also a huge part of my activism and the way that my brain works today, was because I had that experience as a kid.
So how has it been being in America with, obviously, you know, we're in the midst of a pandemic, the summer's happened, and obviously George Floyd, and the second time round of this kind of a big moment. I'm saying a big moment. It's not like a debutante ball, because Black Lives Matter, obviously, yeah, you know, as a movement appeared, was it 2015, 2016?
I think even earlier. Like, it, yeah, it's crazy how it's only now really blown up.
Yeah, and I might be ignorant on the on the etymology of, you know, I remember it being a big thing and being talked about. And then obviously in the summer again, there was this kind of moment. So you're a British person in America whilst that's all happening. What was that like?
It was really interesting. I learned a lot, because even though there are some shared experiences of people of color globally, America is so unique to America. And I really kind of highlighted the differences between growing up as a person of color in the UK, as I did, versus in America. So in a way, I went through a stage of mourning. Like, it really, really hit me deeply. And I read a lot, and I listened to a lot of people, went to a lot of protests, listened to a lot of speeches. And I just tried to fill myself with as much knowledge as possible. But it was strange having one foot in it and feeling so connected, but also acknowledging that this is not fully my fight. And I have not had the experiences that lots of these people have, because I didn't grow up here. And also, you know, colorism is very real as well. Like, I'm mixed race, so my experiences as a sort of what would be called a light-skinned black person is different to someone who's a dark-skinned black person. And even talking to my mother in the UK, her experience, who is dark-skinned, is so different to my experiences. So there's so much nuance within race, which really was sort of exposed during this time.
And your mother's from Guyana, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you went there for the first time when you were 20, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. It was when I was researching for my thesis. I did my thesis on illegal gold and diamond mining in the Amazon in Guyana.
Wow. Okay.
And so I went out there and did some research. It was really, really cool, because they have these people who go into, men predominantly, well, actually exclusively, who go into the Amazon for up to a year at the time, and they illegally gold and diamond mine. And there's this whole culture that they build around this. Whereas the legal version go in, massacre the forest, you know, scar it so deep that things can't grow back, and that's the legal version.
Wow.
So I was sort of looking at the ramifications and the political context between the illegal and the legal ones.
So there's no real good way, is what you're saying to me, like the legal and illegal versions are.
Yeah. The illegal one ironically felt pretty good, because they go in with hand tools, you know, what they can carry, and they're just digging. There's not really, you know, there's not really much of an imprint.
Right. As opposed to in an industrial.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So yeah. You were 20 years old, you go out there, but the Guyanese kind of like culture and everything was much a part of your life at home.
Definitely. Foods.
Like, did you feel like a connection? Did you feel that side of your sort of cultural heritage? Did you feel a real connection when you went there?
Definitely. It's weird, because you feel so close to it. And yet, even just the accent, everyone sort of looks at you and laughs, because it's just, you sound so foreign to them. But also, it's like the one drop rule there, whereby if you're any kind of related, it's like your immediate family.
Right.
So you have second cousins and third cousins, and they treat you like, you know, you're a sibling. So it was really sort of family feeling. And I wish we had more of that over here, actually. We don't have that same kind of family camaraderie. And also respect for the elders. Like, there's such a hierarchy of elders there, and you listen and you learn, and the matriarchy. Right. And we don't have that in the UK or America.
Years ago, I feel like it used to be different. Like, people in your family would get older, you'd stay together. And now we have this kind of culture of, I guess, people move into like homes and stuff, and that can't necessarily be avoided. But if we go back like a few decades, I think more people kind of stayed integrated into the family, and because people literally couldn't afford to. So, you know,
yeah,
you had families who were like, no, we all have to live in the same house. There's six or seven of us, and we're in a two bedroom or a three bedroom house. And also mum's not going to move out, because mum's mum and mum helps with the childcare. And yeah, and there's a respecting about the wisdom, the power of age, the wisdom of it, the beauty of it. And it's one of the things I've railed against for such a long time, this idea that age is somehow diminishing as opposed to this beautiful celebration of being alive and 100%. Keeping going, yeah. You know, and it's worth pointing out, you know, we both work in an industry where how we look plays a part of that, and looking a certain way or looking young or looking your age or, you know, all of these things, it's a very hard, that's a very hard balance to get to, to find how to be positive about aging and the beauty of it, but also living in a world that sends out a message to us all saying that women diminish with value. We're like soiled goods that we go off as we get older. And you probably maybe haven't found that as much yet, maybe because you're 29, but...
Yeah, but I'm very aware of it, and you see it, and, you know, you see the amount of work people do in order to try and maintain their youth. And you know, it's naive of me to say this now because I haven't gone through it yet, but for me, like, aging with grace and just letting it happen is something which I'm extremely excited about. But I'm still aware of the wrinkles, and I'm aware of, you know, oh gosh, I can't play 18-year-old anymore. And wherever you are, it happens, that pressure.
And seeing it, visibility. So we'll talk about visibility in a big, broad way as well, because seeing older women, or seeing your race represented, or seeing, you know, someone from the same class as you represented, these are all like, if you can see it, you can be it. So it's really important to be able to, I mean, at 3 years old, you're seeing the most powerful example of it anyway, because you're watching your mum on a stage, 100%. Right? So were there messages from the world kind of saying this isn't for you at any point? Because I felt like that with acting and performance.
Definitely. I think growing up, especially being queer, I so rarely saw queer women of colour on anything, you know, TV, books, film. We just weren't, there wasn't much representation at all. And I think it definitely made my coming out quite tricky because there was a lot of shame around it. I wasn't seeing it in my social life, you know, with my friends at school. I wasn't seeing it in the older people I respected. I wasn't seeing it on TV, and I wasn't reading about it. So I felt like an alien, you know, I felt like an other. And I felt like this was something which wasn't the ideal, you know, that I was going down a path that was second best. But I couldn't help it because it's how I felt. And it was, you know, it's a whole, and I had a wonderful parents who accepted it straight away. So it's not even like I had that from my home. And yet I still felt the shame and this sort of resentment towards who I was. So I, you know, especially with the films that I'm starting to create and the production company that I've started, it's all about representation of marginalized communities and POC and LGBTQ plus individuals. So it's all about, from the beginning of creation, all of the crew, the cast, you know, the production team, the writers, the directors are going to reflect the story being told, so that we can make sure that if the story is about a young black gay boy, that everyone involved has some kind of experience with that, or know someone, so that you can create from knowledge rather than from assumption.
It's a really beautiful film as well. It's shot beautifully. I mean, obviously, I was in LA when you were shooting part of it at our friend's house.
Yeah.
I was staying with them. And it's so the film's called Sunday's Child, and it's a journey of acceptance, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's definitely about a young woman who's struggling with her identity, and you watch her over the course of one day as she journeys towards self-acceptance through finally being seen by a community who embraces her for being just as she is. After being sort of, every sort of step she goes down, there's sort of a door shut in her face. And finally, she discovers this underground world of queer POC creative artists who are just reveling in who they are and so proudly and freely just being themselves. And she realizes, well, maybe I can be like that too. So you sort of leave on this cliffhanger of that first step of what you hope is going to be a long, positive journey.
So is there a plan for like a feature length version of the short film?
It's tricky. I've thought about it. I really have thought about it. I don't know yet. I've got so many other things I want to tell, so many other stories that we're starting to work on and building pitches for. So I don't know whether this one's going to stay as it is or grow. Do you see more when you saw it?
I think there could be more in there. I do. I would love to know what happens to her next, because I think there's a really beautiful moment where Ace is maybe the first person who's given her the license to say what and who she is. And that's really, and it's done with a very deft lightness of touch. It's just a lovely scene. But she's like, say you're a photographer, say that's who you are. Say it, you know, after watching her struggle to sort of come out to her mum on the phone. Because then that was the next question I was going to ask. And obviously your parents were so accepting, but how much of her character is based on you and your experience.
Yeah, it's influenced heavily. I think it's kind of based on collective stories of other people from the community and my own put together. My gran is very religious and she did struggle with it at first. So that phone call is actually based on a real conversation that I had when I was coming out with my gran, and how it crushed my soul just to hear her say, "I don't know what to say." Like she didn't say, you know, much more than that, but just that, you know, I was just hanging on her word and that was what her response was, and it just crushed me. And then now, 6 years later, she loves my girlfriend. She's come a whole 360 and just wonderful. But it was hard, and I wanted to capture that moment and show hope after that as well, because so many people have had a negative experience when they come out, and yet it's that whole "it gets better" message that I wanted to leave people with.
Yes.
Like, it may be shitty now, but there is still hope. Don't give up.
And the idea of telling stories, I guess, from about people of colour that aren't just about pain and sadness. Mm-hmm. And I saw various conversations sort of happening over the summer, kind of going, you know, we want to tell our happy stories too. We want to tell our hopeful stories. But I felt like it was really impactful, because that's the thing. You're getting a glimpse into someone else's world, someone else's experience, and kind of having to have that conversation. And like you say, your parents were very open with it. Where do you think the pressure came for you in feeling your own shame about it? Was it a societal thing, or was it feeling like you didn't fit in, or?
Yeah, definitely societal. I think it literally all comes down to representation.
Right.
You know, all of the pop stars I was admiring, all of the things we're watching, all the pop culture we're absorbed in, there was no of color, queer character or human that I could relate to. And therefore, you know, who are we if we don't see ourselves reflected back to us?
Right.
Within the people that we admire. What does that tell you? What message is that giving people? And I think also representation is so important, because people who don't get exposed to people from other backgrounds or other genders or sexualities, their first experience of people with differences is through the screens that they, you know, the things that they watch on their screens.
Right.
So these shows are so important, because not only are we showing people that their stories matter, but we're also educating people who don't have exposure on a daily basis and telling them these people are just the same as you.
Sometimes I worry, as a person within the performing arts, that I go, maybe we overplay how important stuff is. And then I come back to this and go, no, it is really important. And if you come outside of it from beliefs about identity, and come back even further with ideas about the world itself, or ideas about love, ideas about money, ideas like, when people watch films, what they don't realise is they're gaining beliefs about things.
Yeah.
Like, you are being entertained, but also at the same time, these are the messages that are being received by people sitting at home. So if it's not there, if it doesn't exist, if you're not seeing yourself represented. Because I often, like, it's been my thought process for so long that I've come back round and gone, every now and then I challenge myself and I go, do I think, you know, am I being a bit grandiose? Like, is it that, you know, TV and film, is it like the most important thing in the world? And then I'm like, well, it's the, you know, the main form of like how most people consume entertainment.
Definitely.
So yes, it is important. It just comes back round full circle. So it's about kind of going, oh yeah, I think I was right the first time. The first time.
Exactly.
And of course those people were there, but they may not have been out.
Yeah, exactly. That's another thing. Or they weren't given the roles that really sort of told their stories enough. You know, so often you see the person of color sort of sidelined, or it's a bit role, or it's the role is only there to really uplift and support and exaggerate the wonders of the lead role, you know, but they don't actually go into their own backstory. For me, it's not just about representation. It's about complex, positive representation.
Right.
You know, I want to see that this character is a whole human being. I want to know about these characters' wants and needs and triumphs and tragedies. I don't want to just see them on the screen for a second and think, oh, great, look, there was a brown person on screen. Now I feel better. Like, it doesn't work like that. It has to be well written as well.
I think we can see that as well. I think people see that when it's done in a tokenistic fashion.
Yeah.
When something's popped in and you go, oh, well, that character didn't get any depth, or but like, you know.
Definitely.
Almost like a producer's turning around and going, I did it, see?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're like, no, this, like you say, it needs to have nuance, it needs to have complexity.
Yeah.
So you did that by like getting your entire crew to be, so was it entirely women of colour, or was it women of colour and queer?
No, so all the department heads were women of colour, and then the crew itself was 80% people of color, probably about 70% women of color. And then there were just like a bunch of queer women within that as well. So it was really cool. And obviously you have to work harder at it. And I think that's why people don't bother to really dig people out, because they're not being given the same opportunity. So they're not being given the same exposure.
Right.
So you have to find people. But they were, you know, the crew was so talented and so passionate and so invested in the story that the creation environment was so electric. And I loved it. I loved it. It made so much sense. Having, you know, all the stuff I've done as an actress has just been white male, completely dominant sets.
Right.
You're lucky if there's maybe three women on the whole 300 people crew.
Right.
So to go from that to that was really, really cool.
And essentially it's doing what those guys do, which is kind of going people that I relate to or that I know or mm-hmm. that I have, I am friends with, and give them jobs. Because that's what happens a lot of the time with the white dudes at the top. It's like kind of passing it down to their mates. And then you hear people go, well, it should be like meritocratic. It should be the best people. And you're like, but if we're all starting the race from different places, exactly. It can't be a true meritocracy until we're starting from an equal. So there could be a really talented, black female DOP out there, but she doesn't know all of the people that run the studios, or she hasn't got a director that always hires her, you know, like that symbiotic relationship that you often get between a director and a director of photography, you know. That's what you're doing. You're going, okay, I want to go to my community and directly, I am giving jobs to my friends. I'm doing what you're doing.
Yeah,
but definitely. Because if I don't do it, people aren't going to get the opportunity. So I think that's a really beautiful, I loved that. I love that
Good.
You did that.
Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Aside from that, moving forward, you want to kind of do more like sort of writing and so it's now a production company you have?
Yes. So it's called Bareface Productions, which barefaced is a Guyanese slang word, which basically means someone who challenges the norm, kind of goes against convention, cheeky, outspoken. It's like an affectionate sort of, oh, you're so barefaced, they say. And it's just like, simmer down. So I just kind of wanted to use that word. And it's also barefaced, you know, stripped and exposed and raw, which is the kind of art that I want to create. So like I said, it all centers around uplifting and providing a platform for stories of and about and by marginalized individuals.
So this is exciting. I'm excited to see what else you do next. Before this, though, you set up a network. Now tell me about, is it Shithority?
Oh, yeah. Shithority. Yeah. So that was something that we created with some of the other female actresses in the DC comic book universe TV shows.
Yes, for nerds that are listening.
Exactly.
Maisie's part of the Arrowverse.
Yep. And again, it was just, we so rarely felt that there was a space for women to have conversations about our experiences and our grievances. And we wanted to expand the community we'd made on set to the wider world, and create a sort of empowering space for women to uplift each other and to share our stories. And so it's kind of centers around articles, which the community submit and write it about any topic. And then there's discussions around that and, you know, lots of just positive self-empowerment and group empowerment. It's been a really wonderful space.
I think I read something on there. I went and looked it up when I found out about it, because I didn't know about it. And so this is a few years ago. So this is just Maisie in her mid-20s already like starting a network for women to be able to reach out to each other and connect and tell their stories. So, and I saw a story from a doctor talking about body-focused repetitive disorders, which is bizarre because I have one. I have dermatillomania. And I was like, wow, oh, here's this resource. And it's got brilliant people writing on it and talking. And it's just, you did that. That's an amazing thing that
you've
done.
Thank you.
So I wanted to give that a shout out. Who has influenced you? Who's been a tiny revolution to you?
Oh my gosh. Definitely my parents, hugely so. But and my gran. My gran, you know, she came over by herself with three children from Ghana and all living in one room, found three jobs. She was working around the clock and just made a life for herself in England. And I think the amount that she's been through and yet her resilience and her how quick she is to find laughter is so inspiring to me. But in terms of, you know, people that I haven't had the chance to meet, Maya Angelou is huge influence. Oh, yeah.
Maya is magnificent. There's probably not a week that goes by that I don't think of one of her books or a poem of hers.
Yeah, definitely.
So what's your favorite Maya moment?
I think Still I Rise is the poem that I always go back to, but reading her autobiographies was hugely influential. I only read them all about 2 years ago, and that again, seeing her trials and tribulations that she went through, and also her how quick she is just to sort of show her faults just as easily as her sort of amazing qualities was really inspiring to me. And the fact that she was, what, in her mid-30s, raising a son by herself, being a assistant I think she was like an assistant in a journalism company in Ghana at that point, and yes, then who yeah. she became later, you know, because
yes.
for us, we're told by that point, if you don't know what you're doing, then like, forget about it. And yet, you know, she never forgot about it. And she always kept fighting for what she believed in. And now look, you know, look what she became.
I like that Maya has a lack of frame for her work in that she doesn't feel that she has to force it into a shape. So this yeah. is someone who sang and danced like Calypso songs.
Yeah, totally.
Like, and The Purple Onion was her and Phyllis Diller, like kind of going back. So she was with all the stand-up people before she did Porgy and Bess.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she was part of the cast of that. So then she's singing, she's dancing, then she's writing, she's doing poems. She's an activist. And I honestly feel, I never forget talking with, and I guess they have to remain nameless, but because it was a man who wanted to do a show about feminism. And we were having a discussion and I said, oh, like, have you read any Maya Angelou? And he said, no. And I was like, I just don't understand. If you're claiming to be a feminist and you're claiming to want to write about feminism as a bloke, but like that you don't know who Maya Angelou is,
mm-hmm.
is insane to me. And she's got such, have you ever seen The Iconoclast she does with
no.
Dave Chappelle? Oh, no. It's a magnificent.
What is an iconoclast?
Person who attacks cherished beliefs or institutions.
Ooh, that's a goal. I love that.
So it's like people who challenge the status quo. So it's Maya and it's Dave Chappelle. And they have so many fantastic, like Maya Angelou has that kind of hypnotic way of speaking
mm-hmm.
as well. And you can see Dave wants to, so they're talking about the use of certain words and like the N word. They have a very deep
yeah.
conversation about that. And there's a point in one of her books where she says she believes words are like real things. It's really interesting. She's like, I believe they're like an object in the room. It's like, they're real things. It's like a chair, a book, a word.
Mm-hmm.
And because in one of her books, when she spoke the name of her attacker, the consequence yeah. of that was that he was killed by her uncles,
yeah.
I think it was.
Yeah.
And then she didn't speak for 2 years because Maya Angelou thought words were like so powerful. So that her and Dave are kind of talking about that. And she says, he says he's reclaiming the word. So it's the reclaiming of a word. And she says, you can put poison in a crystal glass, but it's still poison. And she was like, to me, that
wow.
word's...
That's so powerful.
It's really incredible. It's so worth a watch. It's like one of the best things I've ever seen.
Okay, I'll watch that.
Yeah, but the two of them just kind of going through it and how she made Tupac cry.
Yeah, I love that story.
But for me, I think it's seeing someone who's so bold and unashamed in her,
mm-hmm.
in her femaleness, in her... She was a sex worker and then there was an interview on TV. She was getting a prize and... There's another amazing clip where a woman sort of threatened to expose her, the female journalist who was like, I'm going to tell them this about you.
Mm.
And she was like, tell them.
I mean, how powerful is that? Yeah. She's like, I'm not ashamed.
She was like, tell them. I don't feel shame. Like
yeah.
the fact that you think this is something you can hold over me tells me more about you than, you know, Maya Angelou's someone who's I'm so glad you said her.
Yeah,
I can talk about
exactly.
I can talk about Maya for hours. So were there any filmmakers in particular?
Ooh, I think most recently, Barry Jenkins, Moonlight.
Right.
Moonlight really actually sprang. It was one of the big springboards for me deciding it was time to actually start my own filmmaking journey. It's just such a stunning film, A, like the cinematography, the visuals of it, but also it tells a story of black men in a way that I haven't seen them being told before. So it challenges all the stereotypes that we have around black men and around black gay men, and it tells it in such a gentle, delicate, healing and yet tragic way. And I think the script writing is fantastic. And the fact that was his second feature film, the first one was a tiny independent feature he'd done, and he won an Oscar for it, you know, because it was just undeniably fantastic. And he's so gentle. And actually, one of my friends had a role in If Beale Street Could Talk. So she was saying, working with him, he was just so passionate and present and just inspired by the work. And that's the kind of people I want to create with, you know. So yeah, he's definitely a huge influence on me. What's your favorite film?
Oh wow, I did a podcast recently which is Films to Be Buried With, and I have lots of favorite films. So it's really hard because they're not the ones you kind of expect. There's ones that you go, I related to, even though I'm not Southern. Steel Magnolias was like a huge moment for me in terms of going,
I haven't seen that one.
Women's stories matter. So it's Dolly Parton, Sally Field. It was the first film I saw when I was a kid that made me go, oh, the women are the lead parts in this, like the male character stories were minor, so that's in there. And also The Color Purple is one of my big
fantastic
all-time incredible. Like, so I was going to ask you what piece of art have you learned from or has changed your mind about a thing, and The Color Purple for me, not that it necessarily changed my mind, it's the most heartbreaking film, it's the film I like cry the most just like throughout it, but also there's beautiful moments with like Shug and Seeley where she's told she's beautiful for the first time and they have that tender moment, although like Shug's complicated and difficult and drunk and mad, but she's also a star, you know, like there's and Danny Glover, like how evil he is in that film and how at the end you almost feel sorry for him for being that horrific and evil.
It's amazing. And that's the beauty of, I think, good filmmaking and good storytelling in general, is showing the gray around characters rather than there being, you know, the villain and, you know, and the victor. It's very much about, it's humanity. Like, there is so much gray in all of us. You know, we all bounce between our extreme selves. And that's what I'm interested in, is those like textures in between.
Yes, the grey area, the nuance, the detail. But also, my favourite films might not necessarily be the films that have influenced me most. So I would say something like Steel Magnolias and The Colour Purple sort of influenced me in the kind of work I want to talk about. But then sometimes, like, I love Goodfellas and I love Heat. I outright love those as films. They may not be the films that I make, but I love the film. And sometimes there's something also quite nice about being separate from what's being shown. Yeah. I mean, but we've learned to love male stories. We've learned to love, you know, white male specifically stories. We've had to because there was such a long time that was all that was on offer.
Yeah, and it was always the underdog watching the white male finally triumph into his full glory. And you're rooting for him the whole way. Yeah, I mean, like for me, like West Side Story was really powerful for me when I was a kid. Like I watched that film on repeat, obsessed with West Side Story. And I'm thinking back, I don't know why. I think there was something kind of educational about, you know, forbidden love. That's such an age-old concept, and it's so heart-rending, and, you know, being told who you are and what the limitations are because of that. What other ones? Moulin Rouge, growing up, was obsessed. Again, one which I loved, but probably wasn't a creative inspiration. I love, like, films like Tangerine. I don't know if you ever saw Tangerine.
Tangerine, I did see, yes, yeah.
Again, like, shot on an iPhone. Super cool, super creative.
He's the guy who did the Florida Project.
Exactly, love the Florida Project.
The Florida Project was amazing. Oh, that's such an incredible, but heartbreaking as well.
But such an interesting way of telling a story, right? Because it's so naturalistic, hyper-naturalistic, that you feel like you are just a fly on the wall following these people around. And it sucks you in the real way.
Yeah, yeah, it really gets you. When you said Tangerine, I thought of Oranges and Not the Only Fruit, which is the first probably example I can think of lesbian representation or, you know, on TV, on UK TV, certainly.
Yeah.
And I mean, I could be wrong. There could be something else. Did you ever see that?
No, I read the book.
Right.
And I loved the book. I love her as a writer. But I've never seen it. Should I watch it? Is it good?
I seem to remember it being very good, but also like I remember being frightened for the main character in it because she had a religious mother and they basically try and exorcise the gay out of her. It's like, and kind of watching, having watched recently, just watching It's a Sin. Yes. I don't know whether you've got that out in that it is a reminder of, like, in some ways of how far we've come. There's lots of ways still to go, but just the heartbreaking nature of, like, a generation of generation of boys who, you know, and wasn't just boys, but that was kind of what the story was about, I guess.
Have you seen Paris is Burning? The documentary.
Haven't seen Paris is Burning.
That is fantastic as well. And again, it illuminates a world which was sort of shoved under the rug for so long. It's this sort of, do you know what it's about? It's a kind of, it's a documentary about the ballroom culture in New York.
I've seen it referenced on stuff like Drag Race and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's where reading comes from, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right, all of the stuff that you see in, like, Drag Race and Pose, like, so much of it is influenced by the world that is captured there, and, you know, and seeing the pain, but also the immense community and, like, camaraderie between these people, and the struggles, and just how recent this is as well. Like, it's so interesting to think how recently being gay, and, you know, obviously it still is in many parts of the world, but in the places that we were from, how recently, you know, you very much, your life was at risk for being out and proud.
Yes. Yeah. And then culturally, the hangover of that is the shame that then you feel coming through, going, this is why I can't talk about this.
Yeah, it's the stares on the street. It's the laughs behind your back. It's the comments, you know, slung at you as you walk down the street. It's the not feeling safe to hold your partner's hand. Like, that stuff's still completely real today for me. So when you feel that way, it's hard not to internalize that. When everywhere you look, people are sort of looking at you as if there's something wrong.
Yeah. We've still got a ways to go.
Yeah.
We've still got, like, I like to be hopeful, but also we still have a ways to go. So, personal tiny revolutions, and by this, things you've discovered or processes that make a huge difference to your life. So, like, processes for creating, but you've told me a bit about processes for approaching a role, and how you do that and dig into that. And often in the writing world, when they talk about routines and processes, everyone talks about what people do in the morning. And I'm like, what about the rest of the day? You know, like, Hemingway went for a walk in the morning, then he sat down and wrote. But is there anything in your life that's been revelatory, whether it's like meditation or something that you've found that's helped you as a creator and artist?
For me, I'd say morning pages. I don't know if that's something which everyone knows about, but that's something which I really, really love. So morning pages is basically every morning before you look at your phone, or ideally before you even speak to someone, you get your journal and you stream of conscious write down for 3 pages or 20 minutes. And you're not allowed to filter or question anything you're writing. If there's nothing coming to your mind, you just write, I don't know what to say, over 100 times. And it's all about just allowing everything that crosses your mind out onto the paper. And it's this amazing, liberating act that somehow connects to your creativity. And I don't know how, to explain it. It's almost like it takes the plug out.
Yes.
You can't show it to anyone.
It's like a cleanse. It's like a diet cleanse for your brain.
It is.
Like a super cleanse.
Yeah, you're word vomiting.
Like, my brain's just shit itself.
Exactly. It really is. And, you know, you don't read back over it, which is really important, because then you're not trying to curate it. And it really does just free you up creatively.
Yes, you've reminded me that I should go back and do that again.
I love it.
I've got the Artist's Way is on my bookshelf here. So that's where I know the morning pages from. And I found some of my ones from years ago. Sometimes it's just a list of complaints. I'm like, oh, you sound like such a complainy bitch. But actually, it's quite good to get the complaints out on the page, because then I'm pleasant.
Yeah.
I'd like enter the world going, no, now today's my good thoughts and good intentions and... it just really clears, it does clear you out. And also the not reading back, I mean, mine was reading back years and years after.
Yeah.
But I find when I'm writing, my inner critic is very, very strong. And it's a nightmare when I'm going back to the beginning of a script to read through and keep writing on. I'm like, I find myself going, well, that's shit, isn't it? That's like, I'm the worst critic of myself.
I resonate.
I don't know if...
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really good that. And it's also good to stop you being precious, because so often we put, you know, it's like, we're writing, it has to be beautiful, it has to be poetic, it has to be this or that. And to throw that all out and just word vomit is really refreshing. And it helps me, if I go from doing that into writing a script, I find that I'm more fluid and free in the script.
Yes. Yeah. You've inspired me to get back to doing it.
Yay.
So what's a typical day for you now at the moment?
Oh gosh.
Then?
Oh no. Waking up, morning pages, a matcha on the porch, take the dog for a walk,
right?
Which I love again. Walking for me is definitely a meditative thing. do hopefully a couple hours of work, be that on a script, or I'm about to go and direct the show that I was on for 4 years, Legends of Tomorrow. So I've been doing a lot of prep work for that. Or learning lines. We've got an audition.
That's amazing. So I want to hear about this. So like, especially in the universe that it occupies, you know, like the comic book universe, and coming from that, to have you like, and you're not even 30 and you're just directing TV. I'm so impressed.
Thank you.
I'm so impressed. And so do you think like acting on the show has given you a way into knowing how, I always find like on soaps and things like that, I had a couple of friends on soaps that the actors would direct on that because directors would come in and out and the actors are there all the time. The actors probably had a bit more power actually than the directors.
Yeah, 100%.
But the actors know how it works technically, that we're going to cut on that line, the camera's going to go there. So it's not even about your best take. It's about,
yeah,
it's about, are we going to cut the line here to that? Because it's multicam or whatever. And so you know the set and you know the day-to-day and you know how it all works. Do you think that helps?
100%. And but also I had to really prove to them that I was serious about this, that it wasn't just an actor's whim. So I shadowed for over a month on 2 different episodes. I did the Warner Brothers director's course as well, which was great and intensive. I created the short film. Like, it's been a whole 3-year process for them to actually say yes. So I'm so, so excited.
Yeah, we're making it sound like I've probably underplayed it by going, and all this before 30, but yes.
No, but it's important.
Yeah, you've been wanting to do it for a while.
You know, it's a big responsibility. I don't know what the budget is, but you know, you're dealing with a multi-million dollar set and, you know, every minute is money and you can't really afford to get things wrong. You've got superheroes, so you've got special effects and visual effects and stunts, and it's a manic, massive world that you're creating. So it's scary, but exciting. And I can't wait.
Is that an episode or is that a block of episodes or how does
one
it work?
Episode. So I'm doing the penultimate episode, which is kind of exciting. So it's a big one. It's a really beautiful one with some emotional stuff, also some big action sequences.
I'm going to be coming to you for jobs, girl. That's really, really exciting. Well, and exactly like you say, it's because a friend of mine, Menage, I think directs on.
Oh, yeah.
I want to say The Arrow. There is one called
Arrow,
The Arrow. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. He directs on that.
Okay.
But he's someone who's, you know, kind of like had to go to America in order to get, like, he did Kid Althood. That was his
sort of
breakout role, and it won loads of awards, but he just found it so hard because it's just a, you know, there's just such a network of like white dudes who do, you know,
definitely
directing. So he kind of had to go across the world.
Well, that's what I did with acting,
right?
It's the same thing. You know, I wasn't getting seen, I wasn't even getting in rooms, and whenever I did get in the room, I was either playing like a street gangster or I was, you know, playing someone like a slave. It was so stereotyped, the casting I was going up for. And as soon as I get in a room, they were like, where did you train and what have you done? And obviously I didn't go to drama school and I hadn't done anything, so I was basically written off. And then I came out to America, and for them, they just want the best person. They want to be the person to find someone. So they just are like, you, come here. And that's how I got lucky.
What are your hopes, and what do you hope to achieve in the future? Where do you hope Maisie is in 10 years, 5 years?
Oh, that's a good one. I mean, I'm really, really, really falling in love with directing. I'd love to be able to say by then I've done maybe 2 feature films and also created Barefaced into being a platform whereby we can also host and screen and actually, you know, basically have a hub of creatives who can showcase their work in a safe space, maintaining creative autonomy. And really, really creating conversation around the pieces. So that's also an educational platform, as well as also just a visual platform.
So basically a powerhouse, and I don't doubt it for a second.
Basically we're going to take over the world. But jump on board.
I don't doubt it. So I should give a shout out to your projects. Well, Sunday's Child's going out to festivals and stuff,
yes,
isn't it?
So
look out for Sunday's Child on the festival circuit. You'll see it. You're going to see it. It's going to be out there because it's a great short. And look out for the next series of Legends of Tomorrow, which is the show that you were in. You're not in anymore now?
Not in it anymore, but I'll be directing episode 14, season 6.
So look out for that. I tell you what you should do is you should definitely go find Maisie on Instagram, because there you can link to all of your articles and all of the other cool stuff that you're doing. You're probably the person with the most followers who follows me. You've got something like 1.5 million or something. But you can read all of the articles and everything else. There's great stuff on there. Anything Maisie related, you can get to there. Anything else you want to plug?
Fantastic. No. stay safe, stay happy.
Kissing Booth.
Oh, yeah.
Kissing Booth
Kissing
3.
Kissing Booth 3. Yes. And we filmed it 2 years ago, so I keep forgetting that it hasn't even come out yet. But yeah, I just did some ADR on it, and it's looking fantastic. And I think it's going to come out some point this summer. So I'm really excited about that.
That was Maisie Richardson-Sellers. Thank you for listening. Come back next week for episode 3 when you'll hear from another great guest. See you then. Bye-bye.
This is a podcast from The Bugle. You can listen to other programmes from The Bugle, including The Bugle, The Last Post, Tiny Revolutions and The Gargle, wherever you find your podcasts.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.